always ask, who can tell me what rayon or viscose is made out of? And people will throw up their hands and say, oil, plastic. You know, they'll throw every possible thing out there and they never land on the actual answer.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. What is rayon made of? Well, keep listening and you'll find out. I learned many surprising things from going down the rabbit hole of how clothes are made. My guide in this journey was Amy Hall of the fashion brand Eileen Fisher. So your official title is VP of Social Consciousness, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
It's really cool. It's a great conversation starter.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had the word social consciousness in my title since we incorporated social consciousness in our mission statement in 2004. The vice president piece was added about a year and a half ago, and I think it's a lot of it about how social consciousness has really become part of the DNA of our company now after all these years. For a long time, it was kind of an add-on and a kind of, if we can do it, we will, but, you know, we're still at the core a company that makes clothes, which is still true, except now we really incorporate this thinking about every fiber and every process that our products are going through in order to be produced from the get-go as opposed to as an afterthought, which is how it used to be.
Amy Hall and I met at the Eileen Fisher headquarters in Irvington, New York, on the banks of the Hudson River. I began by asking her about how she arrived at this unusual position. Don't you kind of want to be VP of Social Consciousness too? So tell me a little bit about yourself, how long you've been working for Eileen Fisher, how you got into fashion.
Okay, so I have been with Eileen Fisher for 26 years. It's been ungraciously expressed as over a quarter century, which I really don't appreciate. And I didn't intentionally come here with any, you know, inkling of a long-term career. I came here originally just to take a break from my first career, which was fundraising in the nonprofit field. And I needed to take a breather and try to figure out how I was going to spend the rest of my life. And basically, I joined this company originally as an administrative assistant. And the link for me was when I was growing up, I used to make all my clothes. I didn't do it in any creative way. I used Simplicity and Butterick patterns, that kind of thing. But I always had this little voice in the back of my head saying, what would it be like to work in that industry? So I wandered in here and I thought, I'll take this job for a couple of years while I figure out what's next for me. And one thing led to another, and we were a small, rapidly growing company, and it was literally like an all-hands-on-deck situation. And so I got to try out a lot of things in the first 4 years that I was here. And after 4 years, I became the company's first community relations manager, where I was turning my fundraising experience on its head. And basically, I created our first processes to give away clothing and small grants to our local community organizations. And that was the beginning of this path towards what we now call social consciousness, which embraces human rights and environmental sustainability and philanthropy, all with the idea of leaving this world a better place than we got here.
In preparing for this interview, I researched all the things I thought I would need to know to talk about how clothes are made: textiles, dyes, factories of clothing production. It turns out that it's so complicated, I thought a good place to start would be with one specific item of clothing. Is the top you're wearing an Eileen Fisher top?
Yes, I'm always wearing Eileen Fisher clothes.
It suits you. Do you want to maybe start by telling me about what you're wearing?
You know what? This is one of those rare moments where I didn't actually look at what this is made out of. Okay, so what I'm wearing, this is something that is not current. It's already a couple of years old. It's I guess you would call it a box top. It's a sweater, very heavy knit sweater. I'm looking at the tag. It's made out of alpaca and organic cotton, and a tiny bit of nylon. This piece was produced, as I said, a couple of years ago, and it was made before we had made a commitment to responsible wool, but we already, for many years, have had a commitment to organic. So that's why organic cotton is called out in the label. And the nylon is used very minimally in any of our products where we may need a little extra strength in the fiber mix because you know, we need things to last. So what can I say about this? You know, for us, design is always first.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a simple question?
Sure.
What's a box top? Because that's a common motif.
Okay,
in your...
so a box top is something that has the shape of a box.
Okay.
So a lot of our clothing, generally speaking, is fitted and may come in at the waist and, you know, kind of out at the top and out at the hips. Box top is very straight. And so what it does for us, it's an iconic shape, for one thing, for Eileen Fisher, but it also is very flattering for any body type. So whether you're small, I'm fairly small myself, or whether you have a little more shape or a little more weight, this is a very flattering style for most women.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's I gathered that was a classic Eileen Fisher design.
It's been on the line since day one. It was one of the very first pieces Eileen designed.
What was, just stepping back a little bit, what was the philosophy in the beginning, design-wise?
So here's the thing. Eileen was a graphic designer, and she, like any woman, would get up in the morning and need to get dressed. And she found herself really struggling to get dressed in the morning. She couldn't find things that she felt were flattering, that were classic shapes, that wouldn't go out of style, that were pieces that she liked year after year. You know, if she would buy a pair of pants that she loved, then she'd go back to the store 6 months later, get another pair, and they wouldn't be there anymore. So she was really simply frustrated getting dressed in the morning, and she felt like, gosh, why aren't there pieces that I can always rely on, that I can always find in the store, in the same way that a Japanese kimono, you know, it's been a useful piece of clothing for thousands of years, or where men, they can put on, you know, a suit and a tie, and that virtually doesn't change year after year. So that was her original inspiration. So she created she imagined four pieces in the beginning, because she's not a clothing designer. And she hired a seamstress to make these four pieces, and she went to a trade show called the Boutique Show at the time and displayed them, and she got a whole bunch of orders. And then she had to think about, oh my gosh, how am I going to price these, and where am I going to get these made? And then she had to borrow a lot of money to get them made. And then she expanded her line to eight pieces and went back to the Boutique Show several months later and got even more orders. And that's when she knew she was onto something.
So in a way, there's a sustainability piece that was built in from the beginning then, because the idea was, you don't buy a piece of clothing because it's this year's fashion. You buy it because it's timeless and you can keep it for a long time.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Although we didn't think of it as sustainability at the time, but that was always part of our original
vision.
But
it is a big frustration as a woman. Like, I remember still somewhat a case, the whole low-cut pant trend that seems to have gone on forever, which, you know, it's really a small percentage of the female population, in my view, that looks good in those, you know.
My 17-year-old daughter loves those.
Yeah, right? Exactly. She's probably just the type. And those age quickly, obviously, you know.
They do. Yeah. If you wear them 5 years after they came out, everybody knows. You know what else is like that? Those pointy shoes. The shoes that have those extraordinarily long ends to them, the toe ends. And now if you see them, they look silly. But at the time they were, I don't know, this goes back about 10 years. Every so often I see a glimpse of them on the sidewalk and I think they need to update their shoe wardrobe.
Okay, so going back to the top that you're wearing. So wool, organic cotton, and a little bit of nylon, you said, right? So let's start by talking about cotton and wool. Just to give you my own background, I grew up in the 1970s. My mom is European, and I grew up with a sort of mantra that it was like some form of cruelty to dress a child in anything other than cotton and wool. But the way these fabrics are made, it takes a real environmental toll, both of them. So let's start with cotton. One of the things I was shocked to learn about cotton is that only about 1% of cotton is made organically.
That's true.
And is that because it's a particularly difficult crop to grow organically?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. Yes, to grow the crop organically requires a lot more labor. It's more expensive as a result. It also, if the farmer has been growing, has been using chemical herbicides and pesticides and fertilizers to grow his conventional cotton, he or she is going to need several years to transition that farm to organic. They have to allow the soil to completely turn over and transition. And in that interim time, how are they going to make money? And the demand for organic cotton, believe it or not, hasn't created enough of a business case for most farmers to transition. So there are some programs that are supporting the farmers to help them do this, but the vast majority of cotton is still produced in these large-scale operations worldwide, and they depend on very cheap labor and very cheap chemical pesticides and fertilizers to create. So the economic value of organic cotton isn't there for the farmer yet.
And they use a dramatic amount of pesticides as one of the crops that uses the most,
yes,
right?
That's right. And water.
Yeah. So why do you think is the demand not there on the industry, on the fashion industry side?
Well, I think that, you know, generally speaking, because organic cotton is more expensive to grow, it's therefore going to be more expensive to purchase by the brands and therefore more expensive to sell. And I think consumers will, if you were to ask them, will you spend a little bit more money to buy something that's environmentally responsibly made? They'll say yes. Mm-hmm. But when they're in the store and they have an option of buying something that, you know, a t-shirt that's $8 versus it, or an organic t-shirt that's $25 or $30 or maybe more, which one are they going to choose?
Right.
You know, there's another controversy brewing, which is even organic cotton, it's very difficult to be sure if when something is labeled organic, it is actually organic. Because, A, there's a lot of fraud in the organic system. People may be buying organic certificates in order to be able to label their food as such or their crop as such. And because of the issue, in particular with cotton, the issue of traceability, it's just really hard to know for sure if something is actually what we think it is when it's labeled. So that's not a challenge that a typical consumer can do anything about,
right.
But it's something that we as a brand are really concerned about and are looking into ourselves to see if we can improve the traceability so that we can really rely on these certifications that we're using.
So do you do that in part by developing relationships with specific growers?
Yes, that's exactly the solution.
Yeah. So I read about there's a farm that you guys work with that you're helping to transition to organic. I found that interesting as a way of sort of investing in sustainability.
Yeah. So it's a farm in New Mexico. And again, like I said earlier, it's going to take years for this farm to fully transition. But because we have established a relationship with them and are guaranteeing a certain level of purchase volume, they're able to keep their farm going. And for that period of time when they're in transition, we won't be able to label the cotton organic. We'll have to label it something different because, you know, it isn't organic. But we think it's more important to be part of improving the supply chain than to just kind of blindly go in and purchase something that we're actually not sure of its origins.
So how I imagine part of the challenge with that is how you convey that to your customer. So is that... I imagine that's part of your job.
Well, we have a whole brand communications team that handles that. And they, you know, where my team comes into play is we have to help verify the information. But one example is we've had a really lovely short video on loop in our stores talking about that exact cotton farm that you just described, just to sort of begin to socialize our customers to this idea of there's another way to source these fibers. And actually, sourcing fibers for clothing is quite complicated. I think any story we choose to tell is complicated. And so kind of how do you break it down into its simplest parts to bring the consumer into it so that they can really understand what they're buying?
Before we move on from cotton, I know that another issue with cotton is that it uses a lot of water to make it into a fabric, right? Mm-hmm. Somewhere I have the statistic.
It's at the growing stage where it uses the most water.
At the
it's
growing
very
stage.
Thirsty.
So, okay, tell me if this is right or not. This is one of the things I found. It requires between 10,000 and 20,000 gallons of water to make a single pair of jeans and up to 3,000 to make a t-shirt. I don't know how they come up with these statistics, but
I also don't know where the statistics are from. I think it's really hard to nail that kind of the number data point. But either way, it's a whole lot of water.
It's a lot.
And the reason organic, of course, organic cotton still uses a fair amount of water, but it doesn't use nearly the amount that conventional cotton uses, because once this soil has recovered, it actually holds on to the water longer. You know, soil that's been depleted of its nutrients because of the chemical fertilizers, it can't hold on to the water. So the organic farm uses less water than a conventional farm, cotton farm.
That makes sense. It probably has more organic material in it, which mm-hmm. means that it retains mm-hmm. more water.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So it's the process of the growing of the cotton itself that requires...
That's the primary process. But like, you know, when you think about a pair of jeans, stonewashed jeans or any kind of jeans, most jeans these days have some kind of funny treatment, you know, a design treatment on them, whether it's a laser cut or some kind of whatever. A lot of that does require a lot of washing. The fading of jeans, you know, you can buy them pre-faded. Most of them are faded to some extent. It's all been washed and washed and washed.
Okay.
So there is a fair amount of water involved in the processing as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So going back to the top you're wearing, we've covered the cotton. Talk to me a little bit about wool. What are the issues with wool?
Well, so with wool, so again, just taking a step back, we've estimated that of all of the product that we make as a company, about 90% of the fibers used in our product start at the land level in some way. They have to be grown and harvested in some way. Wool is harvested from sheep, of course. Actually, what I'm wearing is alpaca, but this is a similar story, which is that sheep, any kind of animal that provides hair for fiber, has to eat. It has to live somewhere. It has to graze. It has to be shorn. You know, it's going to have babies. You know, there's a whole animal husbandry side to this. So what we're talking about is the animal welfare piece, also the land health piece, the ecosystem piece, and traceability. So most brands, they don't have relationships with their farms. They don't know where their fiber is coming from. They're buying their fiber or their materials in some kind of perhaps an auction setting or from another vendor, you know, and maybe these fibers are blended from multiple countries or multiple farms. It's really hard to know. So what we're trying to do is establish relationships with specific farms and then link those farms up to the mills and then to the dye houses and then to the manufacturers, the finished product suppliers. So starting at the beginning rather than at the end of the relationship in the supply chain. So what that means for us is we have relationships with the farm that and the producers that create our alpaca product in Peru. We also have relationships with farms that create what we now refer to as our responsible wool product that comes from Argentina. And what we're looking at is how are those farmers caring for the animals? What are those animals eating? Let's say they're grass-fed animals. How is that grass being cultivated? Are they using chemical fertilizers for the grass? Or better practice would be, are they able to move the animals around to give the grass time to replenish? So what we're leading into now are regenerative agricultural practices so that we can really tell the story of how our product is contributing to restoring the earth, not just to doing less bad.
I want to ask about the geography a little bit. With the alpaca, for example, you said one of your goals is to link the farm to then the mill to then where it gets dyed and so on. So can you list the trajectory for me? Or just imagine, maybe not for this particular sweater.
Well, in the case of alpaca, we partner with a farm in Peru that raises the alpaca and shears them and processes the fiber all the way to point of production. So
it's on a spool of some localized sort by the time they're done with it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It starts as hair, and then it gets spun into yarn, and it goes to the dye house, and then to the finished supplier.
Okay.
If it's fabric, it starts at the farm level, and it goes to the mill to get made into fabric, and then the dye house, and the finished product.
Okay.
So...
when you say the finished product, is there a
the
treatment
sewer,
that happens?
The sewers
or
the knitters.
Okay.
Yeah. And depending on the fabric, Oh, there could also be a blend happening, right? So if
of course.
It's like
so
silk
your
cotton,
sweater, for instance, is a blend, right?
So that, you know, that blend can happen at different levels. It could happen at the yarn level, or it could happen at the weaving level or whatever. But sometimes if you were to map some of these supply chains, they literally go to two or three different continents by the time they finish making it. And so this is the part that's hidden that a consumer wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I like to use the example of cotton versus silk, or organic cotton versus silk. So we have for many years sourced organic cotton in the U.S., and that supply chain has shifted a little bit, but that cotton would have been flown to Switzerland for spinning into thread, and then to Canada for turning into fabric, like a sort of a t-shirt fabric, and then back to the United States for turning into finished product, sewing. That's a big footprint for an organic cotton product, but it's made in the U.S., right? In the case of silk, more than 90% of our silks are made in China. Some people are not happy that we make product in China. However, the silk is cultivated in a little region outside of Shanghai, not too far from Shanghai, and then transported all within a 150-mile radius to the spinner and the fabric producer, and then ultimately turned into final finished product, sewn in a factory all within a 150-mile radius. And it's Blue Sign certified, which means that the dyes being used on that silk are the best available dyes. They're the least toxic to the environment. And the only transportation of any consequence is getting that finished product back to this country for distribution. Hopefully it gets transported by ship, sometimes by air, which is not ideal. But, you know, you have to, as a consumer, be really tuned into what value is more important to you. Is it organic? Is it low carbon? Is it the dyeing process? Some people have allergies or, you know, issues with chemistry. Is it the geography in terms or the political situation? There are lots of different values, and it's really hard to buy one thing that is perfect. I would say there's probably no product out there that has all the values wrapped into it in a neat package.
One, so it puts a lot of responsibility on the brands in a way, right?
Yes.
Because you guys are the ones doing the heavy lifting and trying to establish that relationship with your customers where they trust that you're doing the best you can. That's very interesting. I also wanted to talk a little bit about rayon viscose.
Because
that's an interesting one in terms of how it's made, and you guys have taken an unusual approach with that.
So what's funny about rayon and viscose is I speak frequently to design students or college students who are studying like sustainable business or something. And when I get to this little section on fibers and materials, I always ask, who can tell me what rayon or viscose is made out of? And people will throw up their hands and say, oil, plastic. You know, they'll throw every possible thing out there, and they never land on the actual answer, which is wood pulp. And, you know, the jaws drop when they realize that it comes from wood pulp. So that's part of that 90% of our fibers that we use in our company, in our brand, coming from the land. So viscose happens to be a very strong seller here among our product offering. And we made a commitment several years ago to ultimately eliminate viscose from our product line without actually knowing what we were going to replace it with, because it's such a really great material in terms of its performance and drape and all of that. So viscose, rayon, lyocell, tencel, these are all forms of the same thing. They all come from wood pulp. Tencel, which is a branded version of lyocell, is our kind of gold standard, because if you can imagine trying to make fabric out of wood pulp, what would that require? You have to break the wood down into a soup, kind of, and like a little messy soup, and extrude through, kind of like, if you can imagine, like a spaghetti mold, a little fiber. And in order to do that, it requires a lot of chemistry. So Tencel recycles almost 100% of that chemistry and just uses it over and over again. So at least in the processing, we're not expelling that chemistry back into the water table. It's being reused. And so it's the most, I don't know. I almost hesitate to say most environmentally friendly. I'd say the least environmentally impactful of all of these versions of this fiber. Viscose uses new chemistry for every new batch. So the other thing...
And my sense is that it can be quite harmful to the people who are handling
very
it, right?
Toxic, yeah. Yes. Some people, you know, in our company have visited those facilities where the viscose is produced, and it's apparently, you know, very toxic smell there. It's just bad. You know, we just know it's bad. But the other thing is, what about that wood? Where's the wood coming from? And several years ago, we were approached by an organization called Canopy. And I think their website is canopyplanet.org. And they came to us with the news that after the paper industry, the apparel industry was the second largest user of wood pulp in the world. And we were really shocked. And again, you know, we kind of went through this revelation ourselves of, oh my God, viscose and Tencel and all of that are made from wood pulp. So we signed a commitment. We were one of the earlier brands to sign on with Canopy to certify that any of our cellulosic fibers, any of those fibers, are not sourced from ancient or endangered forests. And we've maintained that commitment. We've been working with one of our key suppliers, Lenzing, and they've signed the commitment. So we're attacking it both from the wood pulp source as well as from the chemistry.
So quickly, do you have favorites and least favorites fabric-wise from an environmental perspective?
Oh my gosh. Well, my favorite would be anything recycled. Preferably something that's actually been worn before and is now being used again, whether it's in its original form. We take back our clothes from our customers. We've been doing it for 10 years. And although I'm not wearing one today, yesterday I was wearing a sweater. I got compliments right and left. And I had gotten it in our Renew store, which is a store where we sell vintage Eileen Fisher clothes. And they're all one of a kind at this point. And the idea is, can we extend the life of those clothes for as long as possible? We don't all love our clothes equally, right? There's some things we'll keep for a couple years or maybe 5 years, and then we lose that blush. But it still has a lot of life, so we collect those back. And then the things that we can't use, we turn into other clothes. We may cut them up and make new clothes out of them, or we may cut them up into tiny pieces and use them in a felting process that then results in this gorgeous, very design-driven upholstery kind of fabric that we make wall hangings from or pillows. So personally, my favorite fabric is something that is recycled or upcycled.
Nice. What are your thoughts about synthetic fibers, polyester, and things like that? I feel like there's a trend of recycling a lot of those plastic materials as well, plastic bottles and so on. And from an uneducated perspective, it gives me pause a little bit. Like, on the one hand, it seems like, okay, it's good to recycle these materials. On the other hand, the idea of wearing plastic kind of rubs me the wrong way, as it were.
Yeah, it's a funny choice of term. You know, if we were going to use any synthetic, and we do have to occasionally, our first choice is recycled. So the idea is, can we source anything that doesn't require reliance on fossil fuels? Right? Unused fossil fuels. So that's okay. If you have to use it, I would say use recycled. But I agree with you, you know, in the long run, so here we are in the year 2019, as we're recording this now, we know that all the plastics ever produced up to now in history are still on this planet. They don't decay quickly. They could be around for another 1,000 years. So anything that is made from plastic or a fossil fuel is, you know, we have to think about, where is that going to end up in 10 or 20 years when that item isn't used anymore, or maybe even a year or two? Landfills are filling up. Anything that's in the landfill, it doesn't just sit there and dissolve. Everything gets leached back into our land. I mean, I'm really concerned about the quality of the soil and the quality of the water that we're leaving our children. And so my feeling is, can we completely move away from reliance on synthetics ultimately? There's a beautiful movement you may know about, biomimicry, that tries to answer the question, how would nature do this? So are there solutions that we can land on that maybe naturally occur in nature already, whether it's a waterproofing solution, a stretchy solution to something, a dyeing, you know, something that may help us avoid having to dye. And I think we're just scratching the surface as a population or a society in understanding what possibilities already exist in nature, so we don't have to invent something from using man-made materials that won't leave the earth ultimately.
You mentioned our children. It makes me think also about what kinds of jobs our children will take on at one point. And it seems like, you know, as difficult a situation that we've put them in, they're going to have a lot of work to do in this area too. So just briefly before we leave plastic, so another issue that people are concerned about is microplastics going into the water when clothes are washed, right? Mm-hmm. What do you know about that?
Well, I mean, those, again, are largely from fabrics that are made of recycled plastic bottles or are synthetics because they break off, the little fibers break off. And apparently there are more microfibers in the water per cubic inch than there are plastic bags and plastic bottles. So these are invisible to the human eye. So again, I go to, you know, yes, we have to clean up the water, but how do we prevent more from going into our water table in the future, into our water sources in the future? And that to me is about finding alternatives to synthetics and to these quite celebrated products made out of ocean plastic and recycled water bottles. And I think, you know, that's a stopgap. It's totally a stopgap. Yeah. It doesn't solve the problem in the long run.
Yeah, I agree with you. So let's talk about the people who are involved a little bit, because I'm struck by reading your mission statement. You know, I just recorded an interview about the Pope's encyclical on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's really striking about that is how closely he links the environment to social issues. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really of a piece for him. Mm-hmm. And that's true in your mission statement as well.
Yes.
And, of course, it makes sense. So one of the challenges for you is to try and ensure that the workers throughout the world who are making the product that you ultimately sell are earning a living wage, have good working conditions, and so on. Talk to me a little bit about the challenges involved with that.
Yes, so you're right. It's a huge concern of ours, and I want to be really clear, not all of our workers earn a living wage. It is an aspiration of ours. It has long been an aspiration of ours. And I think what we're realizing the longer we're in this work is how hard it is to get there. It's really easy from the outside to look at a brand like us and say, well, that's crazy. You should be able to insist that your suppliers pay a certain wage in order for you to give them their work. And it's not that simple. First of all of the suppliers we use are independent businesses on their own. And if somebody were to come to us and make a demand on us about, you know, our own employees, I think we might take issue with that. So there's a whole relationship building that happens. The second thing is we're only one of several brands that are in each of the factories we use. So while we may pay at or above kind of the competitive rate for our product, who knows what the other brands are doing? And not all of the workers in the factory are working on our brand, right? So from a systemic point of view, simply paying a slightly higher rate, for example, on our end to just go to those few workers who are working on our product doesn't make sense either. And because supply chains shift a little bit depending on what you're making, every supplier specializes on different types of product. We may this year make a particular kind of sweater or jacket, and next year we may not make it. So we have to shift suppliers. We have to find the supplier that makes what we make. What's going to happen to the workers in that prior supplier until the system changes and the system raises everybody up? Oh, and I will mention one more complication, which is actually very seriously embraced by us. We recognize that it's not all on the supplier in terms of the responsibility to do the right thing for their workers. We recognize the pressure we put on the suppliers, the short turnaround time, the number of design changes that we might make, or changes in order volume, whether they go up or down, and yet the delivery time still remains the same. And so we may be making a bunch of changes, we're adding a lot of stress into the system. The supplier has to turn this around, still deliver it by, you know, whatever the date is, and that may result in perhaps lower wages for the workers who are putting in a lot of overtime. It may result in lack of transparency because the suppliers don't want to tell us that they're now having trouble meeting all this overtime payment because we've only agreed on a certain rate. It's a very complex system. So we are in a multi-year process right now to really examine our internal processes from design to sales to product development, like everybody in the process, and see where we can create more efficiency, where we can shorten the timeline on our end to give the suppliers a little more time. And this is a long-term effort. So all of these things roll up into why it's really hard to achieve a living wage. And I'm not trying to say this to get out of it. I'm just kind of saying it to say this is why it's taking us a long time to get there.
It's difficult.
Yeah.
Do you try and have a conversation with other companies, with other brands as well? Because obviously the more brands are trying to do the right thing, the more likelihood it is that things will change, right?
Yes, we do. We more likely will do it through sort of an organized, maybe an industry gathering. There have been a few, some of which we've hosted ourselves, just to come together and say, what's your position on living wage and what's your position and where, you know, what countries do you work in and where can we align? We've spoken out here in this country around raising the federal minimum wage so that it gets closer to a living wage. And that might be another route we choose to go down the road, maybe in other countries. There are a number of collaborative movements, living wage movements that we've looked at. So yes, we talk with other brands, we get involved where it makes sense for us at the policy level and on the brand collaboration level. And for all the reasons I mentioned before, you know, it's still challenging. The real change will happen at the systemic level. And I left out the trade unions, which are fairly weak in this country, but not as weak in other countries. We have not engaged formally in, you know, discussions with them, but I think that they may hold part of the solution down the road as well.
Seems like there's an element of diplomacy.
You know, all of this work, whether we're talking about environmental sustainability or human rights work, it's all about change management, and it's all about influencing human behavior. Whether we're talking about influencing our own employees to think differently about how they do their work, whether we're talking about influencing our factory owners or the managers in the factories, we're talking about influencing other brands. Had somebody told me in the beginning, you know, what the required skills would be to do this work, that should have been right at the top of the list. And I'd say we've kind of learned as we go along that no matter what we're talking about, this is all about behavioral change, relating to our customers and trying to, you know, convince them to bring their clothes back or not to buy as much or to try to hold on to their clothes as long as possible before they either throw them away or donate them or whatever.
Yeah. I was thinking about my mom getting ready for this interview because my mother grew up relatively poor. Her dad died when she was young and, you know, she would get hand-me-downs. And I think because of that experience and also because of when she grew up, she just has this habit of really taking good care of her clothes. You know, I visited her over the summer and she gave me some of her clothes. And there were dresses that I remember her wearing when I was little, you know. And she just takes really good care of her clothes. And I think that's one of those habits that we've sort of lost, or a lot of us have lost. So I was wondering, do you have advice for the consumer? How can you be a thoughtful consumer?
You know, where I go with that is, how can we shift consumer behavior away from this kind of instant gratification feeling that we have? It's so easy to go online and order something and get it tomorrow. It's so easy to go into a big box fast fashion store and buy 12 things for $50 or $100. And you may not keep those things for very long. They either will fall apart or they're so trendy that you will be embarrassed to wear them in a year. So how can we shift back, you know, thinking about your mother and my mother too, and many of us have this experience of buying clothes as an investment. We wouldn't buy an iPhone and throw it away in 6 months. That's an exaggeration, but maybe not. You know, let's say an iPhone costs $1,000. You could go into an Eileen Fisher store and buy three or four items for $1,000. That seems like a lot of money for clothing. But if you take care of those items and you love them and cherish them, you keep them for 5 or 10 years, which is as long as you would have that iPhone for. Bring them back at a tiny incentive to turn them in and then maybe buy 1 or 2 more items. I guarantee you, your level of personal satisfaction and happiness will be very high. You'll know that you are not going to be flooding the planet with textile waste, that you haven't raped the earth through overproduction of clothing and fiber, that your closet is easier to manage, that your daily stress is lower because you have in your closet what you love to wear and nothing more. There's something about that that we have to get back to. I think it's challenging. I mean, I'm a human being and I like to have new things just like the next person. But I think if we just slow down a little bit, buy a little bit less, and really cherish what we have, that will get us a long way.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Less is more. I mean, yeah. Really. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's an issue as women, too, because we're constantly being sold these images of who we should be and how we should be. And I see it with my daughter. My daughter's 9 now, and she is becoming sensitized to all of these images of fashion and glamour and so on. Seems young to me, but apparently
it's so
it starts
true.
Very young.
It's so true.
And, you know, it takes up so much time and so much energy. You know, I want to be able to convey to her, like, you know, it's fun to enjoy this, but don't put too much energy and too much time into this, you know, because there are other things.
You know, you can be creative with a few items. I actually think the creativity, the opportunity for creativity is greater when you have, you know, restrictions imposed on you. And you can create with jewelry. You can create with wearing your items differently than you might wear them. You can mix and match. You can borrow. You can trade with your friends. You know, there's so many things that you can do to have fun with clothes that don't involve just buying more clothes all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think the challenge could be, you know, how can you rethink how you get dressed and what you wear and how you engage with your friends around clothing? There could be something fun, and that could be a really fun Instagrammable story. You can get your daughter started on that.
That's interesting. You said you have a teenage daughter.
Yeah, I have 2 teenage daughters.
You have 2 teenage
yes.
daughters. Do you talk to them about this?
Yes, and I would have to say I'm not very effective. My older daughter is, you know, she has more pairs of blue jeans than I can understand. And for her, each one of them represents a new and different kind of outfit. Now, I have failed. I know. I have failed completely in trying to influence her. And I tell her all the time, every time she orders something, you know, think about the footprint, think about the fiber, think about where it's made, all of those things. Thankfully, our other daughter has absolutely no interest in fashion. She only wears hoodies and sweatpants. So maybe between the two of them, they balance out.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, this has been super interesting. Is there anything you would like to add that I haven't asked?
You know, I would just end by saying that in the same way that we as consumers have learned to ask questions about our food, whether we're in a restaurant or at the seafood counter, where did this come from? How was this raised? I think we should really be asking more questions of the brands as well. We listen to every person who writes to us, and also we welcome questions in our stores, and I think we all should be doing that no matter where we're shopping. We're going to learn a lot, and we're going to impact and influence those brands to do a better job.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. For more information, go to my website, in-the-weeds.net. You can also follow me on Twitter at InTheWeedsPod. To support this podcast, please leave me a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell a friend. I'll be back soon with more. Happy New Year.